Well, I think it's just like any interaction with a stranger. Ask questions. You talk to somebody long enough, you can find something in common.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning. I am your host, Oz Rashid. This is the show where we talk to executives and founders about what it is they see uniquely when it comes to identifying top talent. If this is your first episode, thank you so much for joining. If you're a longtime listener, we appreciate the support. Everybody, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get podcasts and give us a great rating. Today, we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined today by Catherine Mitchell. Catherine is a Senior Vice President at InnovAge, and I'm so excited to have her. Catherine, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much, Oz, for having me today.
I am so excited to talk with you. We have so many things that are common beliefs that we have. You're in the healthcare space. My company does a lot of work in the healthcare space. So I want to dive right in. I want to talk a little bit about the current role and a little bit more about InnovAge, because you've worked in very large organizations. You've worked in startups. You've been on the payer side. You've been on the healthcare side. I really want to make sure that we get into the detail here of the current company so we understand what drew you to it. So tell us about InnovAge and tell us a little bit about the company and scope of your role in terms of what it entails.
Okay, wonderful. So I'm Senior Vice President here at InnovAge, which is a PACE program. What that means is it's a program that helps people that are over 55 that are appropriate for a nursing facility, but we're able to keep them in the community, in their home, with their loved ones, with their animals, and that sort of thing. And so it's for the largest PACE program that's for profit in the United States. We're in 6 markets, and we have over 20 centers.
I love that. So one of the things that's interesting about that is my mom's side of my family is Indian. My dad's side is German. Obviously, in America, there's a lot of people going to retirement homes. They go into these nursing homes. In the Indian side of my culture, my mom always like rails against that. Like, it's always very big to be able to have like family with family. And sometimes the mother or the father will move in. I'm not sure if she's trying to intimate anything there. I have a brother and sister, so we'll see. But I do love the idea of not having to put somebody into a home and stuff where it has a very different environment and community and being able to kind of keep them around the things that they're familiar with. Is that something that you've always been passionate about? Is this something that when this opportunity came up, you've learned more about? Or just walk me through kind of the journey for you there on that.
Okay. So yeah, so just going to start with, you know, kind of my why I got into healthcare. I'm actually the daughter of a young mother that was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 5 and 7. And as a result of her radiation treatments, developed long-term health conditions, congestive heart failure, lung problems. So I've grown in a household where one of my parents was dealing with chronic health conditions. In addition to that, when I was in high school, similar to you, my grandmother moved in with us. It's our family legacy, and you take care of your own and you keep them in the home. And that's particularly nowadays when people are geographically away from their families, or more families, or all the adults are working. It really does take a creative solution like PACE and other senior type programs to keep people in the community.
I love that. And I just think it's such a neglected is not the right word, but we look at baby boomers and as they start to age out. And I just think that when you look at different things and products and services, it's so focused on the younger demographics. And in a lot of ways, like helping and looking at the older community, and as people start to age out, we're all going to be there at some point if we're not already on our way there. And I just think it's really important to be able to focus on that community, because I think it's one that is pretty underserved. But I'm so excited about some of the different things I've seen with companies like Papa and Grouper and InnovAge. It's really about like getting these programs to keep people active, keep people engaged, and to keep them in kind of the familiar surroundings. I really love that. Love to hear about the healthcare journey. I'm interested because you've been in, like we talked about earlier, so many different sizes of companies, right? You've worked in the Fortune 100, but you've also been in the startup space. I'm just interested for you. You're back in the startup space. What fits you? And what about kind of maybe being in a startup is kind of invigorates you and excites you? Because now you've done that multiple times throughout your career and gone back into it with InnovAge.
So I will tell you, just to build on a background that you shared, I did start in the business in a large multi-state MetLife. I went to Prudential. I then had the opportunity to shift to a local provider-owned multi-specialty group that had multiple clinics and really did so, made that shift intentionally because I wanted to understand healthcare from the physician component. What drives them? What motivates them? What's their ability to influence quality and outcomes? And after 5 years with Kelsey Siegel Medical Group, I made the shift back to healthcare, but this time in the Medicaid space. That was my first entree to government programs where there's more vulnerable. And what really drove me there and what I like about that vulnerable place is healthcare is so complex and so convoluted. And even someone like myself that is educated in the way of health plans and how benefits should work, navigating back to my mother and her journey, you know, just navigating that was so complex. I can only imagine those that are underserved, have educational deficits, are older, and it's confusing and it's complex. And so I definitely like that population where it's more about social determinants of health. It's more about health versus just the transactional healthcare piece of it. And then I was given the opportunity to then to go to a startup with Prospero, which is palliative care in the home. And I would say my love and the ability to really impact change is while the larger programs have perceived capital, perceived volume to push change, it really is those mid-sized startups that have the ability to see what's going on more in the community, to be adaptive, to be able to have more autonomy, to implement, to experiment. And so I really do love the local, regional type, smaller organization that's trying to solve a problem.
Yeah, I love that. So numerous things come to mind as you say that. The first one I'll say is I've been fortunate enough to kind of grow my network in the healthcare space and met tons of different executives, chief clinical officers, chief nursing officers, CEOs. And almost all of them uniformly have some sort of story about dealing with patient care, dealing with a family member that had an issue, and then finding this like burning desire and need to go into this space, right? And make an impact. So I love that. And I love to hear those stories. The other side of it, though, is like as somebody that's been there on the government side, on the payer side, on the provider side, and seen so much, for you to say how complex it is and how bureaucratic it can be, right? I mean, it just, like you said, some of these underserved communities or some of these others that don't have the same education levels and things like that, I can just imagine what it's like navigating and going through from that perspective. And that's why people that can shine a light on that and provide kind of clarity there, I just think is such a needed thing. And listen, we can debate all day about the need of the complexity and why it exists and who it serves at the end of the day. But ultimately, the fact of the matter is it is what it is. And so we have to figure out how do we get that kind of care in the most clear and impactful way possible. And I think a lot of times what I'm seeing a lot of is a lot of proactive healthcare, more so than the reactive healthcare system that I think that we see in a lot of this space. And so I think some of the trends that are in this space are really, really positive. And I hope they just continue to kind of grow in that way. And then the last thing I'll say is I'm very familiar with Prospero. Obviously, our company MSH was really helping, you know, drive the talent initiative there in terms of bringing in APCs, bringing in different nurse practitioners, bringing in clinicians. And one of the things that was really one of my companies, we did that probably about 7 years ago now, six, 7 years ago now. And that was one of our company's first forays into the healthcare space. And I've always believed that recruitment in a way is serving a higher calling and a higher purpose in that you're really helping people. Like you're really making a big impact, helping somebody find a new role, which today we were talking about some of the people that started at different companies today in our Monday morning meeting. And we were talking about somebody that had been out of work for a year and then our recruiter called them and helped them find this great opportunity. And they were so thankful and so grateful that they were emotional at the point of acceptance of the offer. That is such a big deal. The healthcare side really even like makes me feel even more gratitude and more fulfillment for our organization because you are having a bottom line impact on helping people and serving others in their biggest time of need. And I know with Prospero in particular, they had such a high growth curve and moving so quickly that a lot of times our ability to fulfill those talent initiatives ultimately led them going into different regions, opening up different opportunities for more potential patients. It just feels like that's like such an important thing. And so like, number one, I'm like, that was where our paths first crossed. I'm just so grateful to have gotten that opportunity and have been able to expand in the healthcare space like that. But also for me, it just means more. It just does. And it's like, it really is something that I take a lot of pride in. It sounds like you're the same. It sounds like your ability that your work impacts so many people in their biggest time of need. It just sounds like that's very motivating for you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then to build on your point about finding good talent, and I found in my career that because healthcare is growing and there's all these different solutions out, and when it comes to the shortage of nurses or physicians or mid-levels, it really is trying to find good talent. And what's been interesting to me is identifying talent, and as folks are out looking for their next opportunity, think about what their skills are that are transferable. Because I've had, you know, there's been a lot of downsizing. And in my past, I've repurposed, for example, my vice president of HR. That same talent of being able to connect with people, critical thinking, high emotional intelligence, communication skills are all transferable. She ended up shifting into a VP of marketing role. And so on your resume, you may highlight transactional things, but be thinking about what your talents are that are interpersonal skill related. And those really, to me, make the most impact. The complement I look for, when I'm building a team, I look for a diverse team. That can be age, it can be culture, it can be backgrounds. And so I really don't want a team of everybody's cookie cutter, everybody, for example, provider relations and doing contracting and network. I don't want everybody to have the exact same experience. I'm looking to draw upon, I'll bring a clinician in, I'll bring somebody that has behavioral health in, I'll bring those transferable talents like HR or just project management would be another one.
So, as somebody that, you know, spends a lot of time in the artificial intelligence space, building software in this space, one of my big takeaways is that the reality is right now we are entering what I think is going to be one of the most disruptive periods of labor allocation that we've ever seen, right? And what usually happens when there's some type of new technology or new invention, you always typically see short-term disruption as we're figuring things out and learning the new ways of working, and then long-term abundance. And so there's no question that we're getting ready to enter this period of there's uncertainty, and then the skills of tomorrow that are going to be needed, the jobs of tomorrow, we don't even know what all of those are. And so I think what you just said there is such a key thing. If I'm looking at one of the wide open frontiers in the talent acquisition space, it's this idea of non-linear skill sets, right? And what it means for the different priorities around a role that you're hiring for. So what I look at as I look at kind of the history of hiring and the way things are, it's always been very linear in terms of this is what their resume says. They have this title. They have this skill set. Thus, they can do this job at this role. But you know what the funny thing is? Here's one of the reasons hiring is so much more complex and more hard and more difficult. Let's say that you're offering that person a step up in opportunity, whether it be title or scope or things like that, right? And we just assume because they have these very linear skills that they're ready to take that next step. When if you're looking at it from a non-linear perspective, that's actually going to be more predictive if that person ultimately is going to be a success in that new role or at a new company or with a new team. And so I just think that you are spot on. And I think AI actually in this case is going to really be able to help us understand what those non-linear skills and behaviors are to be able to translate somebody that looks like an apple into an orange role, but really they're apples to apples. We just haven't been thinking about it that way or looked deeper. So I think incredible point by you. And I think that this is something that's going to be very pervasive as we go forward over the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years and understanding what are actually the skills and behaviors that transfer that allow somebody to be versatile and be successful in that next role or in a different role or at a different company. So you're onto something there. We're going to come back to hiring in a minute. I'm kind of giving away kind of the fun part that we're, I want to ask you a couple more things though. So you are passionate about, even though you're in operations, you're in growth, you're very passionate about this human resources space and you went back to school around org leadership. I want to understand what drove the decision to go back to school for that. And then I'm interested, what are some of the big takeaways that you got from that program?
Absolutely. So my bachelor's degree is in business. I was interested in exploring. I'm an intellectually intelligent person. My youngest had gone off to college. And so I was ready to have the capacity in my day and actually went to got my graduate degree where he was in school and was looking for an organizational leadership program. The school I chose was the University of South Dakota because it had a master's in it. Usually it's a PhD type program. And I was intrigued because the psychology of people, understanding people, understanding teams. I was with an organization that was going through a lot of change at the time. And so it really did arm me to put things in my toolkit to help my team, my organization, my health plan, you know, maneuver through everything. And actually took right out with classes and applied it into my team about functional meetings. And that's where I really got the insight for those transferable skills. We talked about the importance of listening as a leader. Don't assume that everybody wants to automatically move up. Have a conversation about what their career desires are and path. So it was so applicable to my role. I'd moved up in my career by being a high performer and hadn't really invested a lot in the leadership side. And so that's what I have booked now that I recommend to people. And it's just definitely, you know, even the business ethics piece of it, because you hear in healthcare with like Health South Rehab, and there's others where these really profound, cutting edge entrepreneurial people make such great progress. And as leaders, they kind of, it catches up with them. And so that was interesting to me as well.
I love that.
The business ethics.
And we're going to come back to that book recommendation because I want to ask you about that in a little bit. And I love that you got so much out of that program. And I give you a lot of kudos in terms of being somebody that has accomplished a lot in their career, risen up the chain, but wanting to go back and have that nature of wanting to learn more. And be, my mom used to call it thirst for knowledge, right? And yeah, curious to life continue learner. To develop your skills. So I love that. And it sounds like you're highly recommending that for somebody that might be considering it. So we'll come back to that book recommendation in a minute. I think the other thing that really stood out to me about you in our conversations is how important culture is to you. But one of the things that I want to kind of click in here is that I think it's very different in healthcare than it is maybe in a standard organization if you're selling widgets or what have you. So I'm interested, what are the cultural tenets of an effective organization in the healthcare industry? And then maybe if you have some examples of some of the ones you've worked in, what some of those tenets were, where you saw that.
Sure. So I think one of the things that you'll see across culture with healthcare is people tend to be servant leaders if they're in it for the right reason. And one of the things from a culture perspective is it can't come top down. And so one of the best practices was with a local health plan here in Houston, where we really charged that mid-level director to engage, created a culture committee, was really that conduit between the frontline staff all the way, and to really get rid of hierarchy. Because if you're going to be moving fast and solutioning and getting things done, you really need to have the intellectual property of the folks at the front line, the capacity of the directors. And so creating that cultural committee was super helpful. And then as far as what you're looking for, and I mean, as a profile, it really is somebody that has a passion, has a why, and wants to lean in when you're creating how to do things better. When I started till now, all the technology, all the moving things from inpatient to outpatient, moving things for telemedicine, going through COVID, it's all those kind of things. You really have to, if people aren't able to adapt and change, that's another skill set. I mean, as far as culture, it has to be, you can't have a mindset that I'm comfortable and this is how it's going to be. So it's having a culture of almost entrepreneurial type mentality from a pace perspective. And when you see something that needs to be done, lean in and be a part of the solution.
I love that. One of the things about culture that, and I just mean this more generally, is that to me, there's three phases of a good culture to a great culture, right? The good culture, you can go into an office and you can feel it, right? You can feel it. You can see how people move. You can see how they interact. Like, you can just feel it, right? The next phase is when people talk, right? Whether it be about your company, about your culture, to your customers, right? Then you can get a sense of, like, across multiple people, how consistent it is. And do they say the same things? And that's another level for me. And then I think the last level is when your customers feel it at the end of the day, because you have such a strong culture that they feel it in the work that you do, the service you provide, the products you make, whatever it may be. And then I think about that from a healthcare perspective and just how important it is for the patients to be able to feel that organizational culture, whether it be in a healthcare startup, whether it be a Fortune 100 healthcare organization, whether it be at a hospital or within a hospital network, right? You can feel that at the patient level. You know, I've been in some situations where I'm getting care and they come in, it's like, duh, let me draw the blood, let me get out of here, right? It's another step on the manufacturing line, going back to that widget example. And then you can tell the difference when it's like, happy to be here, I'm in service of you, we want to take care of you, we have that bedside manner that you hear about, right? And so often. So I just think it's culture is important all the time, but I just think, especially in a healthcare organization, building it right and doing it right, having something like a committee like you brought up, just can be worth its weight in gold in terms of your patient care and the outcomes that you get. Because I do believe that the type of care you get, not just in terms of how good it is, but how it feels, can really matter for a patient's overall health and longevity. I'm sure you agree with that.
Well, and I think in healthcare, you can't limit the customer to the patient. The customer is the caregiver, now the structure is care teams and being able to communicate. You have, if you're in the hospital, you have shift transitions. And so that's when that patient's at highest risk, is when those transition times. And so the customer is internal, each other. It's the caregiver, it's the patient, it's the other entities that are working together to how the pharmacist is feeling. All those touch points are the experience. And it's all about exceptional service.
Finding the right talent for your team doesn't have to be a struggle. Meet Aon Hire, the world's first hiring experience management platform designed to transform the way you hire. Powered by AI, Aon Hire takes the hassle out of every step in the process. From smart resume analysis to customized interview questions, it saves you time, money, and effort. Plus, with real-time insights from every interview, you can quickly identify top candidates, reduce turnover, and stay on budget. And forget about note-taking. Aon Hire takes care of that for you. Ready to revolutionize your hiring process? Visit aonhire.com and get started today.
I want to jump into the hiring. I know we've started talking talent a little bit already, so I'm going to start here. If you had a core hiring philosophy when you bring people into your team or your organization, what comes to mind when I ask that?
So I look for their story. I interview and ask questions to have them tell me stories. I'll give you an example that happened just last week. I interviewed a young lady for a role and her resume fit that. But when she started giving me examples of how she adapts to change and how, so all these things I'm looking for in culture, I ask an interview questions. Share with me an example. And she used an example early in her career where she had this whole behavioral health background, but she had taken it off her resume because her resume was too long and she'd been told she needs to shorten it. And so as I started talking to her, she started telling me more. She spent 10 years in a behavioral health facility as a clinician. None of that showed up on her resume. I actually had a director level job for a behavioral health contractor, and they're super hard to find. And so I pivoted my interview based on the example she was giving me that I wouldn't have found out if I were interviewing her just based on rote, here's my job description, here's where her job degree, her resume says. It really is, when you're interviewing somebody, you need to be a curious person, ask more than yes or no questions, and you never know what you might find.
Yeah, I got to tell you, this is going to sound kind of counterintuitive. I hate resumes. I just really think that they're one of the biggest blockers to great hiring. And the only thing I hate more is these rules that you come up with on what they should be and what you should say and what length they should be. I've heard people say, one page, two page, don't do 10 page. And listen, I think it's important that if you want to get your resume read and understood and you want to get hired, you probably shouldn't write War and Peace. At the same time, I think what happens a lot, people put this artificial barrier on, like, I want to make sure it's one page or two pages, and then they don't include something that ultimately at the end of the day could make or break their viability or their fit for a role. And it's incumbent upon people to dig into that stuff and learn more about the story. I always you know, to me, it's like, and maybe I'm a little bit Pollyanna about this, but to me, it's always about the story. It's always about how you got to where you are, what you learned along the way, what adversity you picked up, what experiences and managers and customers that you dealt with that ultimately tell the story, no pun intended, of who you're going to be post-hire as a future employee. And so the resume a lot of time gets you in the door, but it's that journey that I think ultimately kind of makes up who we are. And sometimes that's not even professional. I'll give an example of what I mean. I had an interview pretty recently where, same thing as you, resume looked really good, right? And I really liked this person's kind of go-get-it attitude and their personality and why they were putting things out. So I just pretty much asked that. I said, well, what you're really like comfortable and confident in who you are and putting yourself out there, what experience did you have that really kind of drove that? And like, actually, it was I moved around a lot as a kid. My dad was in the Army. And so I had to go to different places and I had to make new friends rather quickly. That just made me very kind of overt and extroverted and confident in who I was because I had to do it so much. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had any friends. And so that wasn't on the resume. I didn't know that. I didn't see that yet. I think that's a really important aspect of why this person is who they are and why they would be a fit for this. Turns out to be a sales role that we were hiring for. So it's just that story. I think the better that we can tell that story for an individual, the more likely we're going to find the right person. And that's why I think there's so many things broken in this process that we've got to unveil and figure out. Speaking of that, so you told me a little bit about a good interview experience you had. I'm interested. Maybe you were interviewing, or maybe it was somebody in the interview. You don't have to name names, but I'm interested. What's a negative experience in an interview process that you saw that maybe comes to mind? Or maybe you were going through an interview and you just knew this wasn't the right company for me when this happened.
Well, I'll say one thing that people do that it's an immediate turn off. If they don't turn on their camera when I'm interviewing them, because if it was in person, I need to see the whole person.
I can't stand that for employees on Zoom meetings in my office. It's like, hey, listen, if you're not going to be in office, then I got to see your eyes. I got to see your face. I'm totally.
Yeah, it's the personal connection, healthcare, culture. It's all personal. And then I'll say one of my lessons is with succession planning. I assumed somebody that worked under me would, of course, want to move up, right? Until I needed them to tap them for a succession. And really found out. So it's having those transparent conversations, giving people safety to say, hey, I'm comfortable where I am. And yeah, that was one of my lessons learned. Another key thing for me is asking people what they learned from a failure. Because we all fail and we all learn a lot from failure. So one, if they struggle to tell me a failure, then they are doing enough self-reflecting. They're not going to really fit within our culture, because if we're doing things right and we're pushing the edge of what's good to get to great, then we need to fail. And so that's an enlightening question I always ask.
No, that makes total sense to me. And I agree with you. I think that ultimately at the end of the day, it's a really key thing in terms of being able to see the person, being able to ask those follow-up questions to understand their story. I really love that question. I want to ask this. Is there a way that you get somebody to open up and tell their story without, like, do you have like an open-ended question that maybe you ask and that kind of gets the person going and gets them talking? Is there anything, or is it just as simple as tell me about yourself and then sitting back and then letting them go? Like, how do you kind of get them to open up with you? Because sometimes the interview can be a little bit of an uncomfortable situation, at least initially. They're a little bit nervous. They might be like, I got to think about what I should or shouldn't share here. How do you get them to open up and really reveal that journey to you?
Well, I think it's just like any interaction with a stranger. Ask questions. You talk to somebody long enough, you can find something in common. I look at their resume to see, do they work at a similar place? Is there something about their town that I like? So I try to find a way to draw them out by being open myself. Or I've learned a lot in my past from my failures. Share with me what, you know, so it's not going to be a negative to share. So I make myself a little vulnerable in the interview.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you're very natural. You're very opening. I think you have a natural skill to get people to open up. So I love that for you. And that helps you identify who the best talent ultimately is going to be. What about when you get it wrong? Because we all get it wrong every now and then. Are there any biases that maybe you had to learn through earlier in your career? Or is there maybe a theme that you look back on and said, gosh, I wish I wouldn't have done this when you made a hire that didn't ultimately end up working out?
I've made some mistakes in my past when I've listened to people who were not aligned with me culturally, that were trying to help a friend, which is all great, but I'm listening to my own intuition about somebody versus aligning myself with what somebody else thinks.
Yeah, because their intent is good. They're trying to help you, but they don't know your situation. They don't know, right? It's very nuanced. I mean, many times the manager doesn't know the exact inputs they need to get the right person, let alone somebody else that they ultimately are hiring for.
Take the time to talk with the person yourself and get a feel for yourself, not just hire a friend of a friend.
That's always good advice. What about if I asked you to close your eyes and think back to your best hire? Does somebody come to mind?
I would say one of the best hires they've actually worked with me in four places now is one of those transferable skills. Marketing was getting closed down. She had a natural talent for making connections, moved her into provider relations. She's now with a large 500 level organization doing value-based, super smart. But I took somebody that had raw talent in areas and was willing to teach. So that's another thing too. You have to be willing to mentor. But because of that, have been able to bring her along on multiple journeys with me.
You know that ultimately, if they don't have the answer right away, they have the learning agility and ability and adaptability to ultimately pick that up. And did you know that in the interview, or was it something post-hire? You're like, oh, I really have something here.
I could tell in the interview because she was really prepared and very curious. Yes.
Always.
And had never done provider relations before, but was had a natural curiosity, asked really good questions, and was willing to take a chance and do something new. I could tell through her answer she was comfortable with being uncomfortable. Does that make sense?
No, for sure.
And that's what you need for people to be able to pivot and start a new journey.
Love that. What about what frustrates you about hiring in general? Is there something that you wish, if you could snap your fingers and change, either to make it easier or a better experience? Or like, what do you think is lacking? Because there are some things lacking, obviously, in the way we currently do this. Like, what would you like to see change? Or what's maybe a frustration point for you that you've noticed?
I would think frustration would be procuring good talent. It's really hard to find, sometimes having a choice. I would say, I've already kind of shared people not turning on their camera.
Is it the type of talent that you have for the quality or amount of talent that you have for a given role? Is it identifying that person when they're in front of you? What tends to be like the lacking in that situation? Does it just depend? I mean, maybe you just love interviewing and hiring so much you don't have any frustrations with that. I was thinking something like posting a job and getting 1,000 applicants, or having people deceive in an interview, or is it when somebody...
Oh, yeah. I guess I've worked with organizations like yours to do a pitch where there's such good screening done that I'm really have been the benefit of the pre-screening process.
Okay.
To where candidates that meet my expectations from a profile are worked. And so I think having that conversation with the agency, the HR team, to really talk through what I'm looking for has been, to your point about people misleading, I will go look on LinkedIn. I will Google you. I will and there's a lot of breaks on the resume. People have periods of their life where they need to go take care of a parent, or they get laid off and that's a struggle getting, and that's all good. I mean, that's all okay. I will tell you that if somebody has a resume that they're 2 years, 2 years, 2 years, I see a pattern that is not somebody that I will seriously consider, because not that they're not smart, they're capable, they don't present well. But that tells me they're not able to live with their decisions. That's my bias. But if you leave every 2 years from a role, then that's really about the time that the honeymoon period's over and you've made decisions and now you need to own them or build upon them, or you've had to produce. And so I've seen resumes where there'll be 8 jobs every 2 years they move. And so I do have a bias.
I don't think that's unusual. I think it's a really good educated guess. And then the reality is it could come from a bunch of different reasons, right? It could be they have wanderlust and they just want to move on to the next thing, or they wear out their welcome, or they're uncertain and undecided on what they really want. Yeah, but I do think that more often than not, it's going to be something that's probably a bit of a red flag. What I try to coach people on is maybe ask those questions, maybe say, hey, I like everything else here, but this is kind of concerning me. Can you kind of talk me off the ledge here? Why is this something that for you is not something that should be a red flag, but something that really helps me better understand you?
And they could be following a spouse who's on a journey of their own, right? Like moving up in a company, or it's a med student that moves. So that happens.
That could be explanations, but it's definitely something that you need to dig into and understand. There's absolutely no question about that.
Exactly.
Last hiring question for me, Catherine. What do you do to give candidates an idea of what it's like to work with you? How do you kind of create a, because they're also interviewing you at the end of the day. They're going to go start a job in a new company and maybe they're going to be working closely with you. How do you help them understand what it's like to work at your company, at your role, or with you?
Sure. So one thing I do is I include the folks on my team. So I kind of do the first interview and then I tee up maybe the top one or two candidates and have my direct reports interview and share their experience, get the ability to ask questions, make sure what I said syncs with what my team's saying. And then if there's key leaders within the organization that they will need to work with, influence, I will also have a candidate interview with that person. I mean, not to for them to make the decision for me, but I think it's a two-way conversation. They'll get to meet other folks in the organization, but they'll also be aware of what the culture's like.
Sure. And they're getting different points of view, different perspectives. And I think that's always a great thing when you're making a humongous decision, like taking on a new job. All right, Catherine, that was awesome. A lot of great insights there. I want to take this to a little bit more day in the life. So the first thing I'm going to ask you is, what are you working on at InnoViz right now that you're really excited about that gets you up in the morning?
So right now we're looking at creative ways to improve access. So similar to expanding telemedicine in our centers, looking at buying blocks of time with a specialist. So I love the creative solutioning to the delivery models, and that's what we're working on right now.
That's awesome. And so when will patients start to feel that, or what is that something that there'll be an announcement around, or is that ongoing?
Probably the next 30 to 60 days, because if we need to solve for access. It's interesting, particularly as communities are growing and demographics are changing. For example, here in Texas, as people are, that impacts access to care because you have populations moving in. There's just so many doctors available, appointment scheduling that can cause delays. So that constant environmental scanning of what's going on in the market is of interest to me as well.
Wow, that's good stuff. Stay tuned. More good stuff to come from InnoVision. Catherine Mitchell, what about a book recommendation for our readers? If you wanted to be around org leadership, you can do that. Or if you want to go in a completely different direction, heck, if you want to recommend a Netflix TV show, go ahead.
Yeah, so what I would recommend, which I have found super helpful, is the Harvard Business Review, because it's very diverse. It's quick reads. There's things online. There's times when if I need to do a negotiations training with my team, you can go out and you have access to all those historical academic journal caliber material. So I definitely, that's kind of my go-to for such a well-rounded tool.
I love that. I agree. I have it on my RSS feed and I'm constantly, and some of the best articles I get that I share with people come from the Harvard Business Review. So I think that's a great call out. All right, we're speed round's coming up, but I got one last question. What's some advice that you would give 20-year-old Catherine that you didn't know then, but that you do today?
Be brave, right?
Okay.
Just go for it, because everybody makes mistakes and you learn from them and just keep moving forward.
Okay. And do you think early on in your career, you were hesitant or maybe you weren't as confident to be able to make those mistakes? Or
I think I was more comfortable with established rule and structure versus the stimulation of creating. So that's what the younger me was in. I actually started out in the business. I graduated from college, my undergrad, when I was 20 years old. And I started out as a PR rep in MetLife when I was 20.
Wow.
So I was pretty young, but loved the business, the interactions, as I shared with my mother's experience, could really see how being in this industry could make a difference. But I would have encouraged myself to just lean in when there was the creative opportunity.
I love that. Be brave. Good advice. Mm-hmm. All right. You are a longtime Houston resident. Please confirm.
I am native. I'm a native Houstonian.
Native Houstonian. All right, here we go. Lightning round. First question. Best reason to live in Houston?
The food. Very diverse food. Anything you could possibly imagine in that regard.
What's your favorite restaurant?
I would say probably, wow, so many. Probably Carrabba's. It's a very good local Italian place here. Another one would be Cafe Paquette, which is Cuban food. The family came from Cuba to Miami to Houston. Super good Cuban food. So,
Well, when you come down to South Florida, I'm going to have to bring you up for some Cuban food. We could put the Pepsi challenge there. We'll try that out.
That sounds awesome.
Favorite Houston athlete of all time?
J.J. Watt.
J.J. Watt, one of my favorites too. What a great guy. What an amazing person he is, right?
He did so much for our community and was such a positive influence on the community, on the kids.
He came play for my favorite team, the Arizona Cardinals, the last couple of years. And he was somebody I always wanted on my team because he just seemed like that true gritty football player, stepped up in the biggest moments, great leader. But you're so right. Everything about what he did to contribute to the community and how he sees his work is so much bigger than just sacking the quarterback and the things like that. Houston is very lucky to have an ambassador like him for as long as they did. Great player too. So I love that. All right. Now we know that Houston comes in number one, but I'm going to have you rank the next three Texas cities. Okay. Austin, Dallas, San Antonio.
I would say Austin, then Dallas, then San Antonio.
Because it's Austin, Dallas.
My husband and I had a place there for about 4 years and it's a lot of fun. And then San Antonio. They're all good, right? They're all different. I would say if you're coming new to Texas, which one would I go to first? Probably San Antonio, because it has such a rich history, the Alamo, the Riverwalk. It has the parks for kids. It's a nice engine to Texas, but then you need to see pivot and probably go to Austin.
Okay. I mean, my brother lives in Austin. I've actually never been to San Antonio. I spent a lot of time in Dallas and Houston. Last question. I'm a humongous Mexican food junkie, and there's great Mexican food in all of those cities. What is your go-to order when it comes to Mexican food?
I love fajitas.
Fajitas? Chicken and steak? Shrimp? Which one?
Well, I like steak fajitas with a frozen margarita, no salt.
Okay. Well, Catherine, I think we just figured out when I come to Houston what we're getting. You're coming here, we're getting Cuban. I'm coming to you, we're getting fajitas and margarita.
I have a place.
All right. I love it.
Awesome.
Listen, Catherine, thanks so much for coming on. I had such a good time on the episode. I can't wait for people to hear it. And I really appreciate the insights. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Dallas. Appreciate your time.
Bye.
Take care.